From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Communist China presents long-term challenges for the United States. During a recent visit to Raleigh, a national expert with the Heritage Foundation warned about the importance of addressing those challenges. A two-month break from Raleigh did nothing to make state lawmakers resolve their impasse over the state budget. You'll hear Republican and Democratic assessments of the stalemate. As lawmakers prepare for another legislative session and the 2020 elections, new rankings are designed to show how well those lawmakers support business and free market interests. And we'll take a closer look at the way North Carolina pays for transportation projects. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The state of Kansas is set to become the next state that will expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Now, that news has some in North Carolina wondering if or when our state will follow suit. But our next guest says that expanding Medicaid is a poor decision, whether you're the first state to do it or the 50th. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He writes frequently about Medicaid and healthcare issues at johnlocke.org. Jordan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, interesting story that was published in the Winston-Salem Journal, in which a Wake Forest University professor named Mark Hall told the reporter that North Carolina is part of a small group of states in the southeastern part of the country that is a stubborn outlier, essentially, in not expanding Medicaid. Your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I think bad policy is bad policy, and it doesn't matter how many states are doing it. We still, you know, are trying to resist that here in North Carolina to not have some of these negative effects come in. So, you know, we need to remember that the Affordable Care Act made Medicaid expansion optional to states. And so states still have some autonomy to say no. And just because other states are doing it doesn't mean North Carolina should follow suit and, you know, implement bad policy here.
Jordan, remind us of what the Medicaid program is supposed to do and who it's supposed to serve.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a program that started in the 60s for the lowest income individuals, you know, pregnant women, children, those that are disabled, the elderly, you know, the most you know, at risk and most vulnerable people in our population. And so what Medicaid expansion does is it expands the eligibility threshold up to 138% of the federal poverty line to include able-bodied childless adults into this program for, you know, the most at-risk individuals. And so we see that, you know, as a problem that the scope of this program was for, you know, the most at-risk individuals, and to expand it up to these individuals that don't meet that criteria, you know, it's just an expansion of government welfare, and that's not the direction that we should be going to fix some of these complex healthcare problems.
That is such an important point that you brought up, because there may be some folks who think that, well, there are all of these people, half a million of them, who qualify because they're poor or they are widows or they are the elderly, that they would qualify for the original intent of Medicaid to be that social safety net. But what you're saying is that the proposal here in North Carolina by Governor Cooper and his allies is to expand what the program is meant to do and add in all sorts of other people who have other options.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, our Medicaid program already serves over 2 million people, over a fifth of our state. And so, you know, there's all kind of problems currently in the Medicaid program. And so, you know, it doesn't make sense to, you know, put a new priority on these, this expansion population, the able-bodied childless adults, when we have 2 million people that currently qualify for our very generous Medicaid program. And, you know, it's one of our biggest budget line items. And, you know, it seems like a financially reckless move to just kind of blow it up and say, yeah, we'll take the federal money and we'll expand, add another half a million people. And that's just projections. We don't know how many people would actually sign up. What we see in other states is that the projected and actual enrollment are very different numbers. And so states are kind of stuck with dealing with that after the fact, trying to make up budget deficits. And, you know, they do that with new taxes or taking away funding from other parts of the budget. So, you know, we need to think about, you know, what this would do to the state of North Carolina. And we already have a very, you know, full Medicaid program. And so taking care of those people should be our priority. And, you know, we can work to make the private insurance market better to provide for these folks who would be eligible for an optional Medicaid expansion in North Carolina.
Jordan, if North Carolina went forward and expanded Medicaid to this whole new group of 500,000 people or more that you've just defined for us, what kind of impact would we have on the current legitimately enrolled recipients of Medicaid?
Well, you know, we have very rural population here in North Carolina. And, you know, we have what we call medical deserts where there's not a lot of physicians in the area. And even the physicians in the area, they may not accept Medicaid. So, you know, we have these structural systemic problems with people accessing healthcare, and just, you know, giving people an insurance card paid for by the government doesn't, you know, get at any of those root problems, why we have people that can't afford insurance and why they can't access medical attention where they live. So, you know, we don't think that's the right way to approach this by just extending people an insurance card. We have deeper rooted problems that we need to solve, you know, before we expand a welfare program to, you know, this new population.
In fact, don't we have wait lists for current recipients for services that they need that they can't get?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, a population that would like to be treated for their, you know, chronic conditions at home. These are the intellectually disabled group. And so to make their care more accommodating, to provide them at home care, there is a wait list for that. And so, you know, these are the people that the Medicaid program is supposed to be caring for, the most disabled and the most needy folks in our state. And so, you know, those are the people that we should be prioritizing with a state funded health insurance program.
Jordan, I know that you have done a lot of research into the private insurance market and options that those 500,000 people or more have, mm-hmm. other than Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And being moved onto the Medicaid rolls. What about that? Do they have affordable private insurance options?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of folks that are currently eligible for Medicaid expansion, or if North Carolina were to expand, they'd be eligible. They're already currently eligible for a $0 monthly premium Obamacare plan. And so, you know, they do have options. There are, you know, association health plans, hopefully to come soon, short-term limited duration insurance. There's a ton of other options here. And so what we don't want is to, you know, expand Medicaid and crowd out the private individual market. And that's what we see in these states. Idaho, who just recently expanded Medicaid, the next year, Obamacare enrollment was down 14,000 individuals. And that's what we call crowd out. And, you know, that has negative impacts for those that are currently buying their insurance on the private market. And projections in Kansas show that 55,000 individuals currently on private insurance would switch over to Medicaid. So what we're doing is just shifting who's paying for the cost of this health insurance from private payers to public payers, taxpayers. So, you know, that's one of the impacts that we would probably likely see in North Carolina, a massive decrease in the individual market now being paid for under Medicaid.
Every time we talk about this, Jordan, I walk away from our interviews thinking, you know, Medicaid expansion, really it not the best option mm-hmm. for the people we're talking about who have legitimate needs for affordable health
Absolutely.
Insurance and health care. My goodness, we all want that, of course.
Yeah.
But there's other options for them. And it leads me to this question. What is the appeal then to lawmakers and policymakers around the country in expanding Medicaid when there are other ways to help people who need help?
Well, you know, I think it's an easy option just to take the federal funding. I mean, the federal government is paying for 90% of this, but keep in mind that, you know, we're running almost a $1 trillion deficit a year. So all this new federal spending for Medicaid expansion would come from new debt. So, you know, that's a big issue that we see, and, you know, one that we want to not contribute to anymore here in North Carolina, because that's how this law is paid for, by new borrowing. So, you know, it's negative impacts across the board.
And we are all the federal taxpayers. reimbursed.
That's exactly
so
right.
So it's not as if we are not paying the federal portion. We are. It's just taken out of our paychecks.
Right.
And we don't see it.
Exactly. And, you know, borrowing more money, increasing the federal debt, that has broad negative economic consequences.
We've been talking with Jordan Roberts. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Jordan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. China generates lots of headlines these days, many of them negative. What should we know about America's complicated relationship with China? It's a topic Walter Lohman addressed recently in Raleigh for the Jesse Helms Center. Lohman directs the Asian Studies Center for the Heritage Foundation. He joins us now. Just how different are the United States and China?
Looking at it just right at this moment, you know, where each side is, we just see the world from different perspectives, opposite perspectives in many ways. The relationship between the state and citizen foremost, the idea of natural rights that the United States has and has really internalized. I mean, you don't have to read John Locke to understand that as an American, because as an American, you have internalized it. It's a part of the way you look at the world, and we take it for granted that governments around the world are going to look at it the same way. I mean, it's universal, so you do have Chinese people that understand it and see it that way, but you don't have the institutions in China to support it. So on the other hand, the Chinese have a one-party, one-state system that doesn't believe in the rights of man or natural rights or anything like that. So we look at things from a very, very different perspective. And then there's historical differences. There's differences in the way we think the world should be managed and different interests that we have in parts of that conflict very directly.
Some people are talking about decoupling the American and Chinese economies.
I think the biggest problem with this is a basic human inability to deal with scale. You know, you got to look at the scale of what's going on. The you know, 500,000 foreign companies are invested in China. $1.6 trillion we have in trade with the region as a whole, and the fact that you have thousands of suppliers going back and forth across borders and everything else, it's just way too big to decouple. I think what will happen if we try to decouple, so we can take action that intended to do that, we won't decouple. What we'll do is we will separate the United States from a lot of these networks. And the Europeans will be a part of it, the Japanese will be part of it, the Taiwanese, the Australians, they'll all be a part of it. We will have set up barriers for our own engagement in all of these networks. You know, so the bottom line is, yeah, we have some fundamental problems with the Chinese, just like we just talked about, you know, whether it's values or whether it's our really concrete interest. But we got to live with them at the same time, especially on the econ side of things. So there's no easy answers. You just got to be able to slog through it.
That's the voice of Walter Lohman, director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. In your speech, you mentioned a riddle linked to American relations with China.
The riddle is that we have to look at Asia, we have to look at the Indo-Pacific as being more than just about China. We're not dealing with these countries just to deal with China. But on the other hand, if we're going to effectively deal with China, we've got to deal with all those other countries. You know, that's the riddle, is that it is more than about China. But in order to address the China problem, we have to be there with all these other countries, telling them it's not just about China, you know, that we care about the way that they're being inundated by refugees, or the way that they are dealing with drug trafficking or development issues or things like that, because the Chinese are there too. And the Chinese are there in a very big way, diplomatically, politically. They go to all these events that they have in the region, all the different conferences, and they're now becoming aid donors to the region. So we have to be there too, being actually a part of the life of the region. You know, I always point this out, you know, this difference, that in the Middle East, you know, conflict is such a part of politics in the Middle East, right? You have people waking up every day and their first thought is, you know, how am I going to get my land back? Or, you know, how am I going to kill that guy who killed my sister? Or, you know, it's a lot about conflict. It's not like that in Asia. For the most part, it's about making money. People wake up every day, from the guy in the street that's selling trinkets to the CEO or tycoon in Hong Kong, they're thinking about ways to make money. And if the U.S. isn't there helping people make the best of their lives, then, you know, we're missing half of the equation. We can have 15 U.S. aircraft carriers in the region. It's not going to make a difference. If the Chinese are the ones there helping people make money and help people better their lives, they're going to get the advantage. We're not. And they're going to benefit their own vision for the region. We won't benefit ours.
You also called the American-Chinese relationship a long, complex struggle. How so?
You can see it playing out now with this technology issue. How do you separate out security threats that come with Chinese investment or with Chinese trading relationships, like with microchips and development of 5G technology and that sort of thing? How do you separate those things out from the broader economic relationship? You know, how do we attack China on you know, cyber theft and IPR violations and things without jeopardizing the entire economic relationship? How do we speak up about what they're doing in Western China with Uyghur Muslims, putting them in basically concentration camps, but at the same time not jeopardize or exacerbate other problems that we have? So that's where the complexity comes in. And I think a natural American recourse is to try to simplify it and to come up with something that's more, let's say, elegant, or that's the most charitable way to put it, is an elegant approach that, you know, can kind of reconcile this, and we can take the Chinese on head to head, and that will, you know, but it's not going to be that easy. We're going to have to slog through these issues, and we're going to have to prioritize over long term without any clear outcome.
You said during the speech, there's no board game solution.
One of the solutions that's out there that we have just stumbled on, that is the people who are debating this, maybe some people in government, I don't think many actually, but a lot of the academics and other people that are looking at this, they're looking at it as this great power struggle with the Chinese, almost a new Cold War with the Chinese. And it's just not going to be that simple of a way to approach it. You just look at the other countries on the board. Okay, during the Cold War, we didn't fight it on our own. We had allies all over the world. Okay, we had allies in Western Europe. We had allies in Japan and Australia, in Southeast Asia. We had allies. So, what happens in this Cold War? Are all those guys still on our side this time? I don't think so. I mean, maybe a couple of them. But I think if they're going to have to choose, if you're in Germany, even if you're in the UK, or if you're in Japan, you know, Japan's on the front lines, are you going to choose, especially Southeast Asia is the most at risk here, are you going to choose a sort of geostrategic struggle that America leads, some sort of theoretical construct about how to confront China, or are you going to choose economic benefit? You know, a lot of people are going to choose economic benefit. And we're not going to have the same sort of coalition that we required to win the Cold War. That's why it's important to look at it in some of its complexity.
That's Walter Lohman of the Heritage Foundation. He spoke recently in Raleigh, delivering the Admiral James W. Nance Lecture for the Jesse Helms Center. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers came back to Raleigh in January after a roughly two-month break, but the time apart did not make those legislators any more likely to reach an agreement about the state budget. Senate Republican leader Phil Berger discussed the outcome of an ongoing budget stalemate.
The state, in reality, has a biennial budget based on last year's funding level, plus the mini budgets that have become law, and the Base Budget Act that was enacted back in the fall. Considering that a bipartisan supermajority actually passed the budget conference report back in June, I believe this is a significant missed opportunity for the state. Nothing in that budget has changed in connection with the override issue. In actuality, Senate Democrats have rejected some additional items that go above and beyond what was in the budget that they previously supported. Those added items include more funding for DHHS, higher pay raise for teachers, not moving the DHHS headquarters to Granville County, and a number of other policies that Democrats and Republicans claim to be priorities. Nevertheless, Senate Democrats have decided that political loyalty to Governor Cooper and his Medicaid expansion ultimatum is more important than funding for their districts, funding for HBCUs, funding for raises for North Carolina's educators.
Across the political divide, Senate Democratic leader Dan Blue blamed Republican colleagues. Blue says Republican lawmakers have not adapted their leadership style to new political reality.
In November, we concluded the second longest session in the history of North Carolina. And we have little to show for it beyond some bruised political egos and educators that have been caught in the crossfire of this battle we've engaged in since last May or June. Little was accomplished because the leaders in the House and Senate did not accept their leadership style to the new reality that they no longer held veto-proof majorities in either chamber. You know, compromise is not a dirty word. Most of it learned it when we were very, very young. It is not a dirty word. It's not a sign of weakness, but I think it's a sign of wisdom. Republicans can no longer keep their heads buried in the sand when it comes to governing North Carolina in this new decade.
That's Senate Democratic leader Dan Blue. You also heard from Republican leader Phil Berger. They offered competing assessments of North Carolina's ongoing budget impasse. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you believe in the importance of free enterprise, it's likely that you'll support lawmakers who also support free enterprise. Well, how can you tell whether they do or don't? Our next guest will help us address that question. Anna Bevan Gravely is Executive Director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, or NC Free. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this tool that you have that's available to people who are interested in politics, interested in business, interested in free enterprise, that helps them determine whether their lawmakers support free enterprise.
Right. So we, at the end of every odd year or long session for the General Assembly, we produce a legislative business rating. And this rating really gauges and rates members based on their understanding of free enterprise as a philosophy.
This is something that you could compile in a number of different ways. Tell us how you do your rating.
So we have two parts to it. We have a subjective and an objective. Subjective is we involve lobbyists, government affairs professionals, key business leaders in the state to provide a rating 1 to 100 in increments of 10 of how they feel like members at the General Assembly are in their disposition toward free enterprise. And the second part is objective, and that's their votes straight up. There's no opinion in that. It's how they vote on particular pieces of legislation.
So you combined, as you said, the objective and subjective and a number of different votes, not just one or two here and there.
Correct. We have 12 in the Senate and 13 in the House that we selected. We have a research committee that gets together toward the end of session. And they go through and look at what did this session hold in terms of free enterprise. So each year is different. because the opportunity to have votes that lend itself toward going in the free enterprise direction or supporting pro-business efforts are different every session. And so this session, it worked out that we had 12 in the Senate and 13 in the House. And some votes were, we looked at multiple bills, but some bills were repeated. And this year we looked at particular House resolutions to the appointment of two members to the Industrial Commission and then a Superior Court judge. And the reason why we looked at those is it expanded the way we view what's impacting the business community in North Carolina.
Briefly, can you tell us some of the other things that you counted? Are we talking about the support for incentives or things of that sort?
There's no incentive legislation and votes in this particular one. In the past, we've had incentive votes. We had the MAP Act. We had Small Business Health Care, the Farm Act. Some pretty popular names this session made their way into our rating. It was hard to really look past those when we look at the importance of business and the involvement that those have on business in the state.
Well, that gives people a sense of the types of things that
right.
you measured. So we are chatting with Anna Beveren Gravely, who is executive director of NC Free. Now we kind of know how you put it together. Let's talk a little bit about how things
yeah.
turned out. So in general, are lawmakers as a whole supportive of free enterprise, or is there some work to do?
As a whole, we've seen a steady uptick in the ratings on average moving toward 100, which 100 is the most, the highest free enterprise rating, and zero is the lowest. There's been a steady incline over the last decade. And that's one thing that we show in our report. We did some infographics that really summarized the information to show the comparative nature of the report. It's cool to see where ratings are, but it's also really important to put that in context.
Now, NC Free is a nonpartisan group, but some people will be interested in looking at, are the Republicans more free enterprise? Are Democrats more free enterprise? Is there any difference? What did your ratings show?
There is a difference. Republicans do have a higher free enterprise rating, but interestingly, the Democrats in the Senate have a higher rating than the Democrats in the House, and the Republicans in the House have a higher rating than the Democrats in the House. And usually there's conversation about which chamber is more fiscally conservative. And we do a chart, an interesting analysis that shows the chambers have gone back and forth between which one is more fiscally conservative in its approach to free enterprise, which I think is encouraging because they're continuing to see some challenge in that.
Well, it's interesting, and it might also be because of the variation of what types of things
Definitely.
Come up from
yeah.
year to year. So beyond Republicans versus Democrats, now let's talk about some of the individual performers. When mm-hmm. you looked at the list, maybe let's start with Senate. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the top performers?
Top performers, we have Senator Paul Newton. He was top, and President Pro Tem Phil Berger was sixth on the list. And all of these members, when we talk about the number, where they rank, we're talking about a 0.25 difference in their rating score. So we're still dealing with a good number of people who are rating above 90.
So someone first or sixth, probably not a huge amount
not
of difference.
Not a big difference.
Maybe a big difference between someone who's 5 and 45.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And looking on the House side, who were some of the top folks?
John Bell was the first on the House side, and Speaker Moore was rated 17. I think that speaks to the strength of his caucus, actually, that so many of them are rated above him. And top performing Democrats in the House were Representative Don Davis Representative Ken Goodman. And Representative Michael Ray.
And then on the Senate side, I'm guessing that one of the top performers is Don Davis.
Yes, is Don Davis, and also Senator Blue, who was at our event at the leadership luncheon in the first week in December.
You put these ratings out. How do you hope people will use them? Either the lawmakers themselves or
yes.
people who are looking at their lawmakers.
Yeah. The value that we have is that we at the Free Enterprise Foundation don't have a legislative agenda. So we evaluate the legislation as a whole for this session instead of saying, like, these are particular pieces of legislation that we wanted to get passed. And so I think that makes the ratings stronger in the sense that we are nonpartisan. We're just looking to advance free enterprise. And so when people, whether you're an interest group or a lobbyist group or a PAC or members, we are a gauge that just provides that particular outlook and can be used as a foundation for future decisions.
Do you hope people will look at these ratings and if they see someone who rates highly, say, okay, that's very good. And if they rate a little bit lower, talk to them about, you know, I'd like to see you more interested in free enterprise and supporting business.
Yeah, absolutely. The impact of this legislation or this particular report that we do is, I think it's pretty limitless because it does approach from such a clear perspective. Meeting with members, talking to them about the way that they approach, whether it's through the subjective rating or their straight up votes in the objective. It's certainly a conversation starter.
If people want to learn more, including the ratings for all 170 members of the General Assembly, what's the best way for them to get this information?
Visit our website, ncfree.org. And we have the legislative business rating from this year, as well as the last decade of LBRs.
That is the voice of Anna Bevan Gravely. She is executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, or as we've been calling them, NC Free. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The Bass Knight Bridge on the Outer Banks, which replaced the Bonner Bridge, is well known to most North Carolinians. But it turns out President Donald Trump also knows about this bridge. In fact, the president used the bridge as an example of oppressive federal rules that make building infrastructure like bridges very costly and very slow. Joe Coletti is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He follows transportation issues and policy here in North Carolina, and he joins us now. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so what'd you think when you hear President Trump talking about North Carolina and the Bass Knight Bridge?
It's always weird to hear something positive from a Republican about Mark Bass Knight, or from any, but, sorry. But the president's, commentary about it, that it took 25 years to build, to replace the Bonner Bridge, and a large part of that was due to environmental concerns and lawsuits and regulations and barriers to being able to replace that bridge. That all made sense. And so it's a very good thing for the president to be looking at how do we ease the regulatory barricades to building infrastructure, needed infrastructure, like the Bonner Bridge or the Bass Knight Bridge like a new runway at RDU, a replacement runway at RDU. That's being held up by regulations. We've seen that with 540 and with other projects across the state.
So how do we go about that? Because on the one hand, there might legitimately be hurdles that a project needs to get over, but what's appropriate and what's inappropriate? How do we decide that?
Well, the existing law has been litigated for 50 years, as folks have pointed out, that it from the time that it was created until the current – until today, that's 50 years worth of lawsuits from environmental groups trying to stop construction projects and infrastructure projects in the name of the law. And so the president's idea is to change some of the regulatory framework around that to ease that. It still has to go through public comments and all of and so it'll be a while before it takes place. But once that's in, once that happens, well, then we'll have another round of lawsuits to figure out the answer to your question.
So while all that goes on at the federal level here in North Carolina, Joe, you know, transportation issues just up one side, down the other here. Let's talk about some of the key factors that determine how we build roads and bridges and how we pay for them. First of all, there was a huge court ruling, and it was in relation to a law called the MAP Act in North Carolina. And this was determined to be unconstitutional. And it's important for this discussion because it was a key factor in how North Carolina planners really made their plans for building roads.
Right.
And they were negatively impacting property owners around the state. Yeah. Give us kind of the Reader's Digest version of what the MAP Act was doing to property owners and why it's ruled unconstitutional.
Yeah. In 1985, the legislature passed the MAP Act, which said that the Department of Transportation could put out a map and everything along there would then be, but it wouldn't have to buy anything in the proposed route. Until they were ready to actually build.
Which could be decades.
Could be decades, in part because of the environmental lawsuits.
Right.
And what that did, though, is it froze the value of a person's house or diminished it. Because if you know that the house that you're looking to build or the property that you're looking to buy for commercial purposes, too, is going to, at some point, be replaced, be torn down and replaced by a road, there's not a lot of value there. And so the court said that that's a taking by the state. And that was part of the reason why they passed the law, was so that the Department of Transportation could pay less to condemn property and take it for their roads. And so it was in the intent, and the courts recognized that and said that that's unconstitutional. You can't do that. You have to pay just fair compensation. And so the Department of Transportation now has probably about $1 billion worth of liabilities to property owners. They've paid somewhere close to $300 million of that already, but still have another a large chunk of that still left. Unfortunately, the General Assembly this past December, and bailing out the Department of Transportation over a number of other things, also limited the amount that the department could pay in compensation to owners under the MAP Act to $150 million a year. So it'll be a number of years more before all of these owners are compensated for their taking.
Unfortunate if you are one of the victims,
right,
of the MAP Act. Okay, so the MAP Act can't be used. It's unconstitutional. What then are North Carolina planners using as the criteria for determining how we build roads or what is needed?
There's a state transportation infrastructure plan that is largely data-driven at the state level for large projects. And that is that. And that's based on the traffic that's going to go through there and the value that's created from the road. And that's at the state level. The largest projects are that. And for as you get closer to local level, there's more local input and less reliance on data, down to about half and half. Half just this makes sense and half the data says this is what it should be. And so that's how most things are being planned now. There's still a question about how much land the Department of Transportation is taking for their projects and if they're overbuilding compared to what they could do and should do to be able to maintain the commercial and residential character of the places where they're building.
So how do we pay for all of this?
Most of the money comes from gas taxes. 40%, well, 40% of the money comes from gas taxes, and most of the rest of it comes from other user fees from drivers. Sales tax on cars that you buy, driver's license, title, tags, all of those things come into the cost that we pay for roads and for most of the rest of the transportation system in the state.
That means that when we pull up to the gas station and we fill up the tank,
right,
most of us just look at how much a gallon of gas costs. We
right.
don't realize that there's a nice little chunk of that that actually is a federal gas tax and also state gas
right.
tax as part of the price of a gallon of gas. Here's the thing, Joe, and you've written a lot about this. We're going to more fuel-efficient cars. Now mm-hmm. we have electric cars. Does that mean that our revenue is diminishing?
It has been diminishing. It has been diminishing for a long time. Actually, it went down further faster in the 70s than recently, because that's where the big fuel efficiency gains were
gas
most made.
Yeah.
But efficiency has continued to improve. One of the things with electric vehicles and with hybrids is that those are high-end vehicles, and so the gas tax is actually becoming regressive because if you have an electric vehicle, if you have a Tesla, you're not paying the gas tax. So there's increasing concern across that, and the Department of Transportation has a commission that's looking at that and will have its recommendations early next year, in early 2021, on what should the revenue structure look like. And we've talked in the past about one of the ideas could be to do a mileage-based tax so that you take a look at the weight of the vehicle, you take a look at how many miles it's driven, and you say that substitutes for the gas tax.
That's why we rely on Joe Coletti, senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. He does all of that analysis. Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.